Welcome to Tilly's Trans Tuesdays. This week, we continue with more hard data on trans life in the 2022 U.S. Trans Survey Results Part 4. We've got satisfaction rates, numbers on detransitioners, and mental health. Hi, I'm Tilly Bridges, your host, and I'm joined by my writing partner, my best friend, my wife, our token cis representation, the lady I'd give a 5-star satisfaction rating to, Susan Bridges.
Hello!
Our returning guest is Sarah Rose Kaplan, an improviser, performer, and trans educator from Houston, Texas. In April, she performed a one-woman show called What is a Woman? A One-Woman Question Mark Show as part of the Joy Who Live Theater Festival, which inspired her to go back to school. This month, she will officially start working towards a master's in philosophy at Cal State LA, where she is the recipient of the Transgender Studies Fellowship and will be working under the trans philosopher Talia Betcher. Welcome back, Sarah.
Thank you so much, Tilly. And wow, I regret not giving you a shorter version between recording these two episodes.
It's good. It's not even the longest bio we have had. So you are
okay,
fine.
Okay, good.
You're totally fine. So I wanted to ask you about philosophy and how you got into that, because you like incorporated into some of your shows in really fascinating ways. And like, I love that. And I've always kind of loved philosophy. But like, where did that love come from? And why did you want to go back to study it?
Yeah, it's interesting you call it a love. I don't consider it a love of philosophy.
Okay.
I consider philosophy in many ways sort of just a manifestation of my particular neurodivergence.
Okay.
It's more compulsive than anything else. That's
how I am with media analysis, so I totally
get
it. Yeah. Yeah,
I have an essay I wrote a year ago called Philosophy is a Curse. And basically, like, I think philosophy is what happens when all the nice, healthy human mind buffers that prevent you from delving too deep into the void have failed. And you slip and you slip and you slip and fall.
And you're like, hey, what's this void? Let's figure that out.
Yeah, what's this void? Yeah. And okay, so I got into it in undergrad, though I was primed to get into it because my grandfather had a master's in philosophy, and my whole childhood he would be like asking me questions about stuff. And
okay,
like, oh, maybe you should read this, or like, what do you think about this? And so I don't know how much it was incepted into me, but in undergrad I majored in philosophy, and in large part it was basically there is this big problem with the universe and the world. As a teenager, I was generally dissatisfied and unhappy. Something about my life didn't feel correct.
Yeah.
I was particularly fascinated with the mind-body problem because I was aware that there was a very meaningful dissociation between my mind and my physical form, which to me was a universal problem experienced by all humans that no one else seemed to care nearly as much as I did.
I felt the same way, yes.
Yeah.
It's somehow both universal and, but it was only me. Yeah.
Yeah, so I spent 4 years focused on the mind-body problem. That's what I focused on in college, questions of consciousness, like what it means to be a conscious mind and what our connection to our physical form is. And a few years later, when I was 25 and realized I was trans, I was like, oh, okay, that makes a lot more sense now. Why I cared so much about that particular quandary that no one else seemed to find interesting.
Yeah, I think a lot of trans people feel the same way, especially when you look at like trans media, so much of it deals with the concept of what is reality, right? Because everything's so broken to us. So yeah, I think we're also being trans very primed to explore those things that maybe other people don't even notice.
Yeah, 100%. And Yeah, okay. So I think philosophy done correctly is bad for you. My favorite philosopher, David Hume, who I just like personally, he's funny. And not I'm not endorsing his philosophy necessarily, but he wrote like a big world impacting philosophy book when he was 23, and then he spent the next 5 years in a sanitarium.
Whoa.
And then he came back and wrote another big philosophy book, and then he's like, I'm done. That's it for me on philosophy. We're not supposed to investigate the void quite so deeply, you know? But so I took 10 years off, and then in doing research for my one woman show,
Yeah.
I found myself returning to philosophy to try to make sense of things. I was trying to interact with the question, what is a woman, that right wing transphobic propagandists love bandying
Yeah.
about, and I wanted to consider it seriously, knowing that that's not what they were doing. I wanted to. And that meant reading a lot of philosophy and trying to understand also, like, specifically, I get the questions that interest me right now are, what is going on with the transphobe? Like, how do they understand what trans people are? What is it about trans people that so specifically frustrates them and infuriates them? And I got really tired of I'd lament to my friends or family, like, why are the fascists and conservatives keep attacking trans people? We're this tiny, like, harmless group of people. And they'd be like, well, you're a scapegoat. And be like, I know we're a scapegoat, but why us? They could have scapegoated anybody. Like, why did we work so effectively? So now a lot of my philosophy inquiries have to do more with that. Like, what is the specific, like, ways that trans people interact with, butt up against the kind of social understanding that fascism wants, that make us so successful scapegoats for them to propagandize? So that's what I'm doing now. It's also very depressing.
Well, okay, but also it is fascinating on its own level, outside of how terrible it is. There's a fascination to it. And I think, like, for me, I've seen people say those same thing, other trans people, like, why are they focusing on us? And I think for me it's because the whole fascist belief system, like white supremacy, is all predicated on their lies about what men and women are and can be, right? And I think that us just existing proves that that's not true. And being happy existing as our true selves proves their whole system is not true. And if you find out one part of their system is not true, what other parts are also lies? And it's all of it, right? And that's what they're so afraid of, I think, even on a subconscious level. And I think there's a lot of people too who have bought into it. And it's the, oh, I don't remember what it's called, but the thing where people who've been scammed, when you point out the scam to them, they'll just double down on the scam, right? Because they can't admit to themselves that
Like
they were
sunk cost
fooled.
fallacy.
Exactly. And so they just, that's why it's so hard to break them out of it, because they don't like thinking they were believing in a lie their whole life, or that their all of society and their family and their parents taught them this lie that they believed was true. And so it's really hard to break those people out.
I think that's 100% true. And then there's that, and then there's the associated question of, like, but why are people drawn to fascism? So, like, to me, I think the attraction to fascism is ultimately a fear of freedom. Like, people find you're an existential crisis is fundamentally like, oh no, there is no objective meaning or value system in the world, and I am laden with this freedom to make all my own choices and have to choose what matters to me and what life I want to live.
And then they don't want that responsibility.
Yeah, it causes a ton of anxiety. I mean, I feel that anxiety every. It's why I can't play open world video games. People are like, oh, have you played Breath of the Wild? And it's like, you want me to replicate in my video games the crisis of not knowing what to do and having to decide. But yeah, I think, so I think people are attracted to systems that allow them to dissolve that freedom into something else. And fascism offers that. It's like, here are these very rigid, clear social roles and value systems for you to adopt. And exactly like so much of the way fascism offers it is, as you said, predicated on your gender roles, like those
Yeah.
serve as such foundational social roles in the game that they're pitching people.
Yep. Yeah,
And
it's indistinguishable from the patriarchy, really. it's the same, they're all part of the same thing, and white supremacy is all wrapped up Right, and the
together.
popularization of it, Yeah. plus the popularization of like trad wife content and stuff, it's not harmless. It's perpetuating. This is a feminist thing for you to do, Yeah. to be in your role, the role that we've already made for you, the box we've already created
Yeah.
that's very pretty, like, and reselling it as empowering to Yeah. be in your place. Right.
Yeah.
That's like a
Yeah.
whole, you could do a whole podcast on that.
We could. Maybe we should. I don't know. We're having such a good talk. This is And you
amazing.
should. But yeah. No, I mean, you're 100% right. That's the frustrating thing with trying to, I'm sure you've both felt it, but like I think as trans people, as trans allies, or just people kind of on the outskirts, so much of what's happening right now is not surprising in the way it is to your mainstream sort of
Yeah.
people who aren't as immediately and directly impacted by it, and thus haven't been seeing it the same way.
Yep.
And like the Cassandra syndrome for me has felt so real. And I've spent years trying to convince friends and family, like, no, do you see, this is fascism, like this thing they're promoting here, like this is what I see happening. And now that it's
Yeah.
happening, it's like, oh, cool. And I have so many people being like, wow, you're like so right about what the fascism was. And I'm like, cool. So about that Sydney Sweeney commercial. And then they're like, ah, you're overreacting. And I'm like, no, stop. I was right before, weren't I? And yeah,
Yes,
but
for
it's
folks who may not have seen that commercial that she is in that says, you know, she's got good genes and it's
great genes.
great genes, sorry. And you know, oh, it's a funny little play on words, haha, but it's also very Nazi? subtly very, yeah, Nazi exclusionist. And so it's, and you got to look for things like that. I mean, that's like part of our mass media is, and you know, it's capitalism wrapped up in that because it's a commercial and an ad, and you have to understand what you are being fed by society all the time, and every little piece of it impacts how you think and how you feel and the world you live in. So, yeah,
Yeah.
it's all there.
It's all there. If you're a listener and you're interested in learning more about that, I highly recommend the book Empire of Normality by the philosopher Robert Chapman. He's an autistic philosopher who writes about the parallel developments of like industrialization into capitalism into our modern economic system, alongside the evolution of medicine, psychiatry, and the understanding of the normal human mind, which
There were
basically
quotes
was,
there.
yes, there were, I
There
was
were
doing
air
air
quotes.
quotes,
Yeah.
which was basically like the medicalization and pathologization of any kind of human mind that didn't fit neatly into capitalism, and
Yeah.
specifically like made you less useful to those who did, were the bosses. So if you're the kind of person who would have functioned perfectly, you might have been odd or different from other people, but you would have found your place to excel and thrive in earlier forms of society or more flexible forms of society. But now you're the kind of person who's just not going to be a good factory worker or not going to be a good office worker. All of a sudden that becomes a pathology when before it would have just been a difference without
Yeah.
value. And really fascinating read. Highly recommend it. A lot of it has to do with eugenics. So if you want more context on the Sydney Sweeney ad, definitely pick that up.
Ah, that sounds amazing. I will put a link to it in the show notes, so look for that. All right. This has been really good, but we have a whole episode to do. We should move
Fine.
on. Okay. All right. So, for you, what has been the most surprising thing about your transition?
I mean, I guess it's what I said last week, which is surprised by the parts of myself I didn't expect to re-encounter, but I should come up with a new one.
It can be the
And
same. That's okay.
no, that's boring.
There's no rules here. This is not a fascist podcast. You have the freedom.
Little Fuhrer inside my head won't allow me. And what has been the most surprising thing? I think for me, as a otherwise extremely privileged person,
Yeah.
I'm white. I went to a fancy private school. I'm not from like an uber wealthy family, but I'm from a solidly like now understand to be rich family in a way I didn't growing up because of
Sure.
I grew up in a context of richer people, but like I come from, as I said, a family of doctors,
Yeah.
and you know, we had a vacation home growing up, and that's not normal. And
When you're a kid, you don't know that, right? You
well,
think
when you're
everyone's got a vacation home, right?
and I went to a very small private school in Houston, Texas, where a lot of my classmates are the scions of oil fortunes, right?
Wow.
So
Yeah. So you're
like
like, no, they're the rich ones. Yeah.
right, like my family was middle class. Like, sure, we had a river house, but my family was middle class because we didn't have a private jet. There were like five
Yeah, of
kids in my
course.
class that whose families had private jets
Wow.
out of like 130. So yeah, like that's just in part the process of growing up and like getting out of that very specific bubble economically. But then
Yeah.
also I think being trans and being having this like one axis on which I am in the world of, I guess, the oppressed and targeted and outskirts.
Yeah.
It forced me in ways that I don't think I otherwise would have necessarily had to really think long and hard about privilege and about
Yeah.
like the unequal ways that our society is structured. And being trans and realizing like learning about cis privilege and recognizing all the ways that I was impacted by it did force me to go back and reflect on like, okay, so what are all the ways in which I am the normative, like dominant,
Privileged one.
empowered, yeah,
Yeah.
privileged class, and reflect on all those things that I might not otherwise recognize, just like cis people don't recognize what I'm going through in this specific axis.
Right.
And I honestly, it's made me a much better and more empathetic person in general. And I think it's like done wonders for my understanding of the world and my like political analysis, which is definitely not perfect. And I'm still coming from positions of extreme privilege that I'm trying to dismantle, but never
Yeah.
will fully. And I often think about like, who would I have been if I were cis? Like, not that a cis white boy from a rich family can't end up as a cool, like woke person, but it never would have been with the same specificity and personal understanding that
Yeah.
I'm able to have a little bit now on these other issues, just through analogy.
Yeah, that's one of the things too that I think always stymies me about like really racist white trans people is like, but you have transitioned and you understand how
Yeah.
society marginalizes you. How do you not see how you are doing that to others? Like it opens, like you said, just like it shows you all the other ways society does this to so many people if you weren't already aware. And so I don't understand the people who then experience this oppression and marginalization that we go through cannot comprehend when they do it to others. I did a whole episode on trans intersectionality because there's a very, very big racism problem in the white trans woman specifically community, and it pisses me off to no end, and I'm so vexed by it
I
how they
think
cannot
there's a
see.
lot of undiagnosed sociopaths.
Well,
That's my aspiration.
that may be part of it.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, yeah, you got to at least put in the work. What are you doing? Like,
Right.
Tilly, I'm sure you and I both still have plenty of unrooted out subconscious racism
Of
just from living in a
course.
racist society and being
And
white.
ableism and all these other things, because our
Yeah.
society teaches us those. And if you don't look for them and try to find them and root them out, you will perpetuate them. That's
Yeah.
the work, right? You have to examine these things about yourself all the time.
But you got to be trying, and I agree with you.
Yeah.
It is frustrating. Yeah, and it's just, I mean, it's the same problem with everybody, right? Like,
True.
why, I guess you
Humans,
could,
we're a mess.
at the risk of partaking in this kind of unrooted out internal racism, like I would guess you might be able to say the same thing if you're a black person looking at black people who themselves remain homophobic, queerphobic, transphobic, racist against other people. Like, there's always members of oppressed groups who fail to extend out like the
Yeah.
lessons to other groups.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's also kind of the foundational like failure of analysis of the poor white person that makes up so much of the voter base for the current fascist movement. Like, you might think that being economically fucked over would give you some insights into like trying to find empathy for, draw analogy to other kinds of groups that are being fucked over by the same system.
Yeah.
And for many it does. And then for many it doesn't. Like, your oppression is the only one that matters. Your suffering is the only one that's real. And then you're looking for ways to, I don't know, feel better by pushing other people under the bus.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Okay, so moving on to my final question for you here before we get into this week's topic. If you had one piece of advice for people who were just starting their transitions, or if there's something you wish you knew going in, what would that be?
I guess it depends on where you are in your life. I mean, there's a big difference between someone starting their transition at 16 and 35.
Sure.
But I'd say either way, remain curious about the different ways you might be that you don't currently expect. Remain open and, yeah, like, I think curiosity is huge. Like,
yeah,
I think all kinds of trans people, like, the idea of the transition goal, and we see an archetype of a person online or in media, and we decide, like, that's going to be my target. And then all the decisions we make are towards performing that until we get there as close as possible.
Yeah.
And then you may or may not be happy at the end, because that might actually have nothing to do with like who you are as a person.
Yeah.
And then you've just substituted one performance for another. And instead, I'd say be agnostic about who you'll be at the end. Like, and use transition. It's already such a huge moment of upheaval and shifting in your life. And use it as a chance to confront the awkwardness of being inconsistent.
I love that.
Yeah, some American, Ralph Waldo Emerson or something like that, said, consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. And I'm a big advocate of that. Like, I, for example, my first year of transition, I went on a ton of first dates because it was a chance to just be in a brand new reset social context with someone I didn't know. And each time I would intentionally try on like a different way of being that I was like, I don't know if I'll like this. I'm going to really try super hard to be talkative on this date. And, or I'm going to really try super hard to be quiet. I'm going to all these ways of being that I might enjoy. It was a very empirical process. And, you know, you have this hour, you're talking to a person, and afterwards you'll either be like, wow, that felt really authentic and good. I didn't expect that. Or I did expect that, but I confirmed it. Or I thought that's the kind of person I wanted to be, and that actually felt super fake and I hated it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so important to try things and be open to find the things that feel like you, and you're find what your own real true person and personality is. Yeah.
Yeah. And most humans, especially after being teenagers, our society isn't really structured to give us the chance to try on new ways of being and new personalities. Yeah. And transition is such a huge opportunity for that. So I'd say have fun and be weird and figure out who you are.
I love that. Let's all be weird together. Yes. Mm-hmm. All right. One more time. Did you want to remind folks where they can find you online after listening?
At Sarah Rose Kaplan on Instagram and YouTube.
Perfect. Okay, a quick warning before we get into things. There will be some discussion of suicide rates and prevalence and where that stems from in regards to trans people, as that's one of the things the survey got a lot of data on. If that will be difficult for you, you may want to not listen to the rest of this episode. All right, let's dive in. 60% of respondents reported undergoing some form of medical transition, including hormones or surgeries. 88% of respondents expressed a desire for gender-affirming hormone therapy, but only 56% reported ever receiving hormone therapy. Among those who have started hormone therapy, 90% were currently taking hormones, indicating a high prevalence of continuation. Oh, shit. It's almost like it really works well for its intended purpose, huh? 29% of respondents reported receipt of at least one gender-affirming surgery. 98% of respondents taking gender-affirming hormone therapy reported that it made them more satisfied with their lives, and 97% of respondents who underwent gender-affirming surgery reported their surgery made them more satisfied with their lives. 97% satisfaction rate. Are you even kidding with these claims that it's harmful? No other medical interventions or procedures have that high satisfaction rate, not even close. Let this be your reminder that according to the World Journal of Surgery, the average regret rate for all surgeries for all people is 14.4%. For trans people, it is less than 1%. Link in the ding-dang show notes. Gender-affirming care works.
Wait, didn't you just say it was 97% positive? I guess that's different from regret.
Right.
Okay, it so is. There's like a 1% or 2% in there who are neutral.
Yeah, they're like, it was, yeah, about the same. But what about detransitioners? So glad you asked. All respondents currently identified as trans and non-binary, but 9% had gone back to living as their sex assigned at birth, at least for a little while at some point in their lives, due to challenges related to social acceptance. Emphasis there is mine, but bigoted cis people are the reason for those 9% who detransitioned. Respondents primarily reported social and structural reasons for living as their sex assigned at birth. For example, the most common reason was that it was, quote, just too hard to be transgender in their community, end quote. Other common reasons included pressure from a parent and experiencing too much harassment or discrimination. Bigoted cis people making our lives miserable, the biggest hurdle we face. But what about people who detransition because they're not actually trans? Shouldn't we worry about them and make transition care harder to access? For their safety, never mind the horrible impact putting more barriers between actual trans people and our transition care causes, I guess? Of all respondents who had medically transitioned, only 0.36% went back to living in their sex assigned at birth, at least for a while, because gender transition was not for them. 0.36%. Not even half of 1%. Should detransitioners who are not actually trans and are cis people who made a mistake be supported? Absolutely. Should their mistake be held against the 99.64% of people who are trans and need it? Absolutely not.
And I do want to jump in here.
Please do.
This is a thing I've been thinking about a lot recently also.
Yeah.
Why are we assuming that there's that cis and trans make a rigid binary? You know?
Yeah.
To me, like, we're so good at debinarizing everything else, but then trans people love talking about the humanity as though there are cis people and trans people. And I don't think that's true. Like, I think, again, these are probably more poles. And, like, I've met people who've detransitioned because medical transition wasn't for them. They weren't enjoying
sure.
the effects of hormones. But I don't think necessarily that thereby makes them cis. And I don't know that they do either, even if they don't identify strongly with trans. Like,
sure.
you tried it for a reason. And it might not have been a mistake. It might have been a perfectly legitimate, like, empirical exercise. Just like when you're doing psychiatric medication, you try on a bunch of ones before you find the one that works for your particular neurochemistry.
Yeah, and it may also be that, you know, you are trans, but medical transition isn't for you, and that is also perfectly valid. So, yeah, it may be that as well. But there are also definitely cis people in there who thought they were trans and discovered that they weren't. So it's, but it's such,
some
it's
middle
such
category.
A small group. Or some middle category that we don't have a word for, and that's cool too.
Yeah.
For those trans and non-binary people who needed access to abortion-related care, 37% were unable to find abortion providers who knew about trans healthcare. And because they were trans, I didn't feel welcome in an abortion provider's office or clinic, 79%. Provider used harsh or abusive language, 38%. I was verbally harassed by staff or others at the provider's office, 32%. Provider refused, 24%. Provider was physically rough with me, 15%. I want to point out this wasn't them seeking abortion-related care from places who don't provide abortions for a multitude of bad reasons. This was them going to abortion care providers who you'd think would be more accepting of trans people, but even there we see transphobia is a huge issue that cannot be escaped. Let's take a look at some data about trans people and our mental health. 44% of respondents met the criteria for serious psychological distress compared to less than 4% of the general U.S. population. A majority, 81% of respondents, indicated that they felt down, depressed, or hopeless at least several days over the past 2 weeks prior to taking the survey. Three quarters, 77%, reported little interest or pleasure in doing things at least several of the days over the past 2 weeks prior to taking the survey. Look at what societal transphobia does to us. We experience over 10 times more psychological distress than the general population, and I pale at the thought of where those numbers are in 2025.
Does it define what serious psychological distress is?
I don't believe it does, although I believe that it has a meaning in like the mental health guide. Like there's a specific definition of it, but I'm not sure that this report gave what that was.
Okay. I guess severe enough to cause moderate to serious impairment, according to the CDC.
We probably can't trust for very much longer because we're in a bad, bad world. Okay. In the year prior to the survey, 38% of respondents considered suicide. Of those who considered suicide, 41% made corresponding plans. These numbers are dramatically higher than the general population at 5% and 1% respectively. Victimization, such as being verbally harassed, denied equal treatment or service for any reason, such as at a place of business, government agency, or public place, or physically attacked, was associated with greater suicidality. 31% of those who had no victimization considered suicide in the past year, compared to 50% for those who were verbally harassed, 53% for those who were denied equal treatment, and 63% for those who were physically assaulted. 78% of respondents considered suicide and 40% attempted suicide at some point in their lifetime. These statistics far exceed the 13.2% and 2.4% reported for the general population. And all of that, all of it is due to transphobia and cisgender bigots. It's not being trans that causes it. It's the way cis society treats you when you're trans that's so hard to deal with. So really take that in and sit with it, cis folks, and let it inspire you to stand up for us when you know we need you to, because we need you to. Sarah, I wanted to ask you, did you feel prepared for the way society was going to treat you after you transitioned? Like, did you know how hard it was going to be? Because I thought I knew how hard bigots would make it on us, and I was still taken aback a bit by how much of it there is and how constant it is.
I guess that depends on what exactly you mean. Like, are you
interpret
talking
it
about
however you like?
Well, I guess the two major ways I would interpret it are like day-to-day interactions in my actual life,
yeah,
like with humans in my life, or broader social things. Like, I started transitioning in 2018,
yeah,
and I, as pessimistic as I was about the direction of our country. At that time, I certainly didn't think we would actually get to the point we're at now so quickly.
Yeah.
And so that has surprised me. Like, because 2018 was probably peak best time for trans representation in the country. And that was great times, you know? We were just months away from ContraPoints being on the cover of national magazines and things like that. So that surprised me, like how vitriolic and effective transphobia would get over the next few years.
Yeah.
In my day-to-day life, I, to be honest, don't encounter much transphobia at all. Again, living in LA, existing in a very specific indie comedy scene in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
I think I'm pretty lucky. I get misgendered all the time. But I don't consider it malicious, so I don't know. In that sense, I would say it hasn't been as bad as I feared it would be, just like personally.
Sure. Yeah, there's always that fear, like, when you come out to people, even people that you know and trust and you know that they're going to accept you, there's still a little part of you that says, but what if they don't? You know, because society teaches us, oh, if you transition, you're unlovable and everyone will shun you. So yeah, it's a hard thing to deal with.
Yeah. But like a lot of the ways that I suffer day to day, it has more to do with like how I feel broadly in society. Like I'm never comfortable using a public restroom, even in Los Angeles. Like,
yeah.
But I've never had any actual negative experiences. It's just this all-pervasive fear.
Sure.
I do remember the first, like, it still happens, but the first few times I went into a women's restroom with some of my cis woman friends, and they just continued our conversations, and they just kept talking to me, and they wanted to talk to me when I was in a stall. And that was super foreign, and it's...
Yeah.
I'm not comfortable with that in general, because that's the opposite of the culture in the men's room. Like you enter,
right?
You pass.
You don't look at anyone. You
space.
Don't talk to anyone.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Conversations will pick up when you both leave the bathroom. But also, like, I don't do much to feminize my voice because in general, I don't care. But
yeah.
In bathrooms, I don't want to
talk
because, like, especially when it's just a voice divorced from people seeing me, then that's where I'm scared of, like, oh, I don't want people to hear me. And I had to explain to my friends who are cis women, I'm like, they'd be like, why didn't you say anything? Like, because this is my voice and I'm not going to go in there and talk.
Yeah.
And I had to like be like, stop talking to me in the bathroom. I will not answer you. I will be silent. But no, overall, again, I've been super lucky. Like, where I live and the people I happen to have intersected with, I guess.
Well, I'm glad for that.
Yeah, me too. And I acknowledge that's a huge privilege because most of my friends have had definite negative interactions.
Yeah.
Even in random places.
I have too, even in LA. Not that many, thankfully, but they have happened and they are pretty awful.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I could tell my funny story.
You have a funny story?
Well, if it helps at all, like whatever.
What's your funny story?
Well, women who like think, is that person trans? Like,
yeah.
I am the complete opposite of that. Like, I don't think anyone.
You don't look at anybody.
Well, that is true. But,
yeah,
like, I knew a trans person for a really long time and I had no idea what they were trans. And someone like eventually told me they were trans. And I was like, what? Really?
You're the opposite of the rest of the people who stare at me everywhere I go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you notice because you look at everyone's faces.
I do.
You always find celebrities in LA and I never do because I'm never looking at anyone. Like, I'm just in my own little thing. But
I think
it's funny.
Trans women are uniquely like keyed into the kinds of features we worry about in ourselves.
Sure.
Like, you know, I look at someone's face and I definitely have this like little phrenologist somewhere in my brain that is like, thinking the brow ridge, the jawline, the, what do I think is, who is this person? And it's bad. It's like, but I'm always trying to clock people out and about.
Yeah, but for different reasons.
Different reasons. Oh yeah, yeah. No, none of it's negative. I'm looking
for us,
I'm
yeah,
looking
I know,
for buds.
Right? Yeah, exactly. That sort of wave or nod or smile of solidarity,
yeah,
with a trans person passing you in the world, always inflates my heart.
Yeah. I'm also always trying to like emotionally and socially clock people. Like it is. I think everyone is secretly trans.
That may be.
People will describe their ex-boyfriend to me and I'll be like, interesting. He likes taking long baths and reading about Buddhism. Sounds pretty eggy. I also want to note there the serious psychological distress, thoughts of suicide.
Yeah.
And I do agree with you, Tilly. I do think the vast majority of it has to do with the way we're treated by society.
Yeah.
But also, though, like, dysphoria is obviously real and can alone cause severe distress and frequently
does. That's
true.
It can.
So if you're someone out there who experiences severe distress and maybe has considered self-harm, and a lot of it has to do with the way you feel alienated in your own body, I just want to make sure you know, like, that doesn't make you a freak amongst trans people either. Like I
Correct.
Too experience distress in relation to my body and feelings of sort of claustrophobia yeah. within it often. So
yeah, absolutely. That can definitely happen. But I think it's also, yeah, important to note how those numbers jump and jump and jump with every negative interaction mm-hmm. we have from society.
And I do think a lot of times that will feel like the primary cause and feel severe, when if we live in a more accepting world and we know the people around us accept us and love us, like especially before we're out, when
yeah.
it's all alone and we fear the worst case for everyone in our lives, or if we're unlucky and don't have people who support us, it makes that internal dysphoric distress so much harder to cope with and process.
Yeah.
And it all builds on itself. And then a lot of it will get attributed to the dysphoria because it's what's present and omnipresent internally.
Yeah.
But the numbers would likely be better. The numbers are better. Like if you live in an accepting family, it's just easier
Absolutely.
To cope with that shit.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was my whole childhood, dealing with my dysphoria and knowing that I didn't have words to explain it. But if I could, I knew that there was no way I would. My parents were so deeply homophobic and transphobic. So yeah, it was awful. Okay. While 78% of respondents wanted counseling for gender identity or transition, only 48% received mental health care for it. Among respondents who discussed gender identity with a counselor, 12% reported that their mental health care provider tried to persuade them to identify only as their sex assigned at birth. Notably, this was much higher, 50%, among those who consulted with religious counselors or therapists. In the survey's sample, 44% of respondents met the criteria for serious psychological distress. According to the National Health Interview Survey, less than 4% of the general U.S. adult population met that criteria. And I don't even know what to say about that. It makes me so mad. It is important to note that serious psychological distress was more common in younger trans folks and more common in assigned female at birth non-binary people and trans men than in any other groups. The survey sample had 6 times the prevalence of past year suicidal ideation compared to the general population, 38% versus 5%. Further, 16% of survey respondents made a plan to attempt suicide, substantially higher than the 1% reported in the general population. Research suggests that structural factors like state-level discriminatory laws and policies, as well as stigma and hostile socio-political climates, contribute to the disproportionately high prevalence of suicidality seen among the trans and non-binary community. When trans people tell you that these transphobic laws stripping us of our rights, our health care, our ability to exist in public will result in dead trans people, that is not hyperbole. It is legislative violence. Living with that kind of oppression is too much for some people to handle, and more importantly, no one should ever have to try to handle it.
And just to compare that, I happen to have data I was looking at for a different podcast.
Oh, wow.
That I did last week, looking at the CDC's 2023 Youth Risk Behavior Survey.
Yeah.
So the same year, but specifically focused on high schoolers, over 50% of trans students at the time of survey in 2023 had considered suicide within the past 12 months, 40% had made a plan within the past 12 months, and 26% of trans or questioning identified high schoolers had attempted suicide in the previous 12 months. So those numbers are crazy high.
Yeah. There have been other studies that say the rates are even higher for kids. It's so much harder for them. So
That's 26% of high schoolers had attempted suicide, trans high schoolers had attempted suicide in the last 12 months, compared to 7.7% of students who identified as not trans. So over 3 times more likely.
Yeah. Research focused on trans and non-binary people have found that social support may be one of the most important factors in reducing suicidal thoughts and suicide attempts. Supportive families may play a crucial role in the well-being of USTS respondents. The survey asked respondents who were out to their family how supportive their immediate family was. Those with supportive families reported less suicidality compared to those with unsupportive families, 78% versus 85% for ever considering suicide and 38% versus 51% for ever attempting suicide. Supporting us, standing up for us, standing with us, it is literally life-saving. We need you. 72% of medically transitioned and 71% of socially transitioned respondents were very to pretty happy, compared to 55% and 52% of those who had not medically or socially transitioned, respectively. Medically and socially transitioned respondents were thriving more, 37% and 36% respectively, compared to those who had not transitioned, 19% and 18% respectively. Respondents who had medically or socially transitioned reported substantially higher life satisfaction, 43% and 43% respectively, compared to 27% and 24% among those who had not medically or socially transitioned respectively. Medical transition for those who want it works. It works. It works. Happiness levels varied substantially by social and medical transition status. Nearly three quarters of those who had medically transitioned reported being very to pretty happy, 72%, compared to over half of those who had not, 55%. Those who had socially transitioned also report higher happiness, 71%, compared to roughly half of those who had not, 52%. Even socially transitioning shows a huge increase in the quality of life and happiness.
Do they provide any sort of control numbers? Like, what's the percentage of cis people reporting being very to pretty happy?
I don't believe for these ones that they had any comparative data with the general population. For ones where they did, like up above where we were talking about suicidality rates and things, that was information included in the report, so I had that there. But this, yeah. I don't believe they had included that in the report, so I'm not sure about that. I think this one was more geared toward how much does transition change your quality of life and how happy you are with everything like that.
Yeah. I just was wondering, because, I mean, it is relevant information for the people who want to know whether, like, I have no idea. But over 70% reporting being very to pretty happy is pretty, that feels high, just like a general population level. Like, so, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if that was more than the percentage of cis people who report being very to pretty happy, for instance.
Yeah.
Or it could be lower. Like, I have no idea.
Yeah, I don't either. But it feels incredibly high. Like, even knowing all the trans people I know and my own experiences and how much happier we all are and how well it has gone for us and how much better we feel, so I don't think I would have thought the numbers were that high. Still, it's even more effective than I thought and have seen in action. So it's really quite remarkable. But I wanted to ask you here at the end if you had any other thoughts about these survey results overall.
You know, I do. My main thought is I want to throw in that, And you're just reporting on the results as they were represented here. And
right.
You mentioned, I think, at the top of the previous episode about this, like, there are all these other axes of intersectionality and identity that intersect with this and affect them. And these numbers are going to look very different between various demographics in the trans population.
Right. I pulled in their overall stats, but they do, for many of the categories, break them down by race, economic class, and obviously I can't cover a 100-page report in two podcast episodes. But so please do check that out. Again, there will be a link to it in the show notes, the full report. You can go look at the more granular data and see how all these different factors affect the results.
Yeah. And just one example of that I wanted to bring up, just from that same CDC source that I was researching before, which again is just talking about high schoolers. But as an example of how this stuff can change, when they broke down the numbers of trans high schoolers who had reported attempting suicide in the last 12 months, and when you subdivide that based on trans youth who are experiencing unstable housing versus those who aren't, then it changes quite a bit. So 23% of trans or questioning people who had stable housing had attempted suicide, whereas 35% of those with unstable housing had attempted suicide.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's quite huge.
Yeah.
And yeah, so trans youth with stable housing had the same rates of attempting suicide as non-trans youth with unstable housing. And then, because that's huge, I mean, that housing security, which is an increasingly large problem because our unhoused population, and including families with children, has been skyrocketing over the last few years.
Sure, like, the cost of living and homes and rent prices are just out of control.
From 2022 to 2024, it's gone up from 582,000 unhoused people to 771,000 unhoused people, which is a ridiculously huge increase.
That's like a 50% increase, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm just bringing this up, not obviously till you're aware of this, because you already noted it, but just to give the listener some context on, like, these numbers are very general, and there's still so much more to learn about them in the sub breakdowns by the different ways people are impacted by different issues. So yeah, highly recommend going playing around with those. And otherwise, I think these results are fascinating. I mean, I love seeing numbers put to the benefits that I think many of us anecdotally are quite convinced of.
Absolutely.
Of the efficacy of medical transition for those who want it.
And even social transition, the quality of life jump and for people
transition.
Was huge. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's amazing because otherwise when you're trying, especially when you're like trying to decide, do I want to transition? Is this what I want for myself? It feels like this leap of faith.
It is. Yeah.
You know,
because you don't know how it's going to go or what you're going to get or where you'll end up.
Right. And yeah. And it remains that. But I hope it's somewhat comforting for people in that space of questioning to see some hard data if they're the kind of mind who is comforted by that.
Yeah. Yeah. The odds are it's going to go well because it has for most trans people, according to this. Then that's why this survey is so important, right? And it was run by trans people. The questions were all designed by trans and non-binary people. They administered the whole thing and they parsed all the data. So it's all of a community effort. So I'm so glad we have it because we didn't have any kind of information like this. Like even their 2015 report was so much smaller in scope and respondents. And, you know, they didn't have the reach that they have now. So it's a really important thing. And if you have the time, even if you don't, pop open the link from the show notes to the full survey results and just skim through it. You may find a couple of charts and bits of data that shed a lot of light on things for you. It's really important stuff. So, and I'm also, there's a link to it on the site, which I believe they've renamed to Advocates for Trans Equality. It was two organizations that merged. But I've also taken the entire PDF of the results and I'm going to host it on the Trans Tuesday site as well because I don't want it to disappear. It's too important. So I'm going to make sure I keep a mirror of it there. So you can find it in either of those places.
Can I share one extra
tidbit? Yes.
This is one I've been spreading around everywhere. It's not directly relevant to this, but it is relevant to this.
Intriguing.
These are results from 2023.
Okay.
And why are they reporting on the category of 18 and up? Tilly, Susan, why are those the numbers?
I would think because, I mean, and like, yeah, this report, they have results from 16 and 17 year olds, but they did not include them here. And I feel like that's because minors very often are not free to give true answers or they're monitored. They might not have even been able to take the survey, you know? And so
an adult might have had to consent to their information being shared.
Right. And so they might not have been able to answer as truthfully. Yeah.
But 18 in our country, legally,
you're legally
an
adult. Yeah.
And there's been a lot of trans teens out there waiting, hoping, counting the days till their 18th birthday when they get to be adults. However, y'all might have noticed that places like Children's Hospital of Los Angeles or all these other hospital systems are specifically removing access to trans healthcare for people under 19.
Yeah.
And that is because of the January 28th executive order protecting children from chemical and surgical mutilation, which for the purposes of the order legally defines child as an individual under 19 years of age. And it just arbitrarily moves that up a year, where 18-year-olds, for the purposes of trans health care, no longer count as adults, even though they are in every other aspect of our society.
Yep.
And
yep.
This is one of those many things. It's a Sydney Sweeney commercial. It's a thing that someone might be like, well, I mean, that's not a big enough thing to care about, right? But it matters a lot.
It does.
That they're arbitrarily redefining just long-standing like legal
norms.
Yeah,
and you can tell that it's all bullshit and discriminatory because, of course, they are not using that executive order to stop surgeries on intersex kids who cannot consent to them and their parents force them on them all the time. In fact, this is a thing that's appeared in many other trans cases that I've linked to articles and research about it that states that previously, before what's going on now at the federal level, with states that had restricted gender care for trans kids, always had explicit carve-outs so that it could be forced on intersex kids to make them conform to the false gender binary. And that's like the most transparent thing that shows you they don't actually care about kids. They only care about making people conform. And that's horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But just one of many reasons why, as you noted, a 2025 version of this survey would be significantly more bad.
Yeah, the numbers would be much sadder. But thank you, Sarah, for being here to discuss all of this, especially since some of it was kind of tough to talk about.
Oh, yeah. No, thank you so much for having me. I mean, this stuff's important to talk about.
It is.
And I'm not going to say it was fun, Tilly. Well,
understandable.
But it wasn't.
Parts of it were fun. Parts of it were fun. And parts of it were a little tough. And that's somehow how life is sometimes. So.
And I actually love data. And I'm lying. It was fun. Even the sad statistics, they're fun for me. I like data.
Statistics can be fun. What they mean is not fun. We can have that delineation and that's okay.
And that's the beauty of numbers. Cool. Divorced from the real human context.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
These 2022 U.S. trans survey results are so important because it is evidence of what trans people have been saying for, well, forever, really. We know who we are, and transitioning socially and medically works. And withholding it from us, legislating against it because it makes you uncomfortable, because it proves cis-hetero-patriarchal white supremacy is founded on lies, is cruel and unconscionable. Hopefully, you already knew that. If you didn't, now you do. And we've got the data to back it up. Tilly Bridges, End Transmission. Tilly's Trans Tuesdays is hosted by Tilly Bridges and Susan Bridges, with audio editing and sound mixing by Jillian Morgan. The written essay version of this week's topic and all past topics is available at tillystranstuesdays.com. Special thanks to Daisy and Jane for the use of Sorry Not Sorry as our show's theme music. Please stop by and show your support at daisyandjane.bandcamp.com and soundcloud.com/daisyandjane. You can find me at Tilly Bridges on Blue Sky and on Mastodon at tillybridges@mastodon.social, and you can find Susan on those at Susan L. Bridges. You can find Jillian at Audio Jillian on Blue Sky. You can join the Tillyverse Discord server by following the link at the very bottom of tillystranstuesdays.com. We hold regular watch parties for the Matrix films and other trans movies where I do a live Q&A, and it's blossomed into a wonderfully supportive, compassionate, kind community of friends. We'd love to have you join us. If you'd like to keep up with all the writing that Susan and I do, you can sign up for our newsletter at birdguestbroadcast.com. If you enjoy this show, please take a moment to leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts. The largest segment of our listeners find the show there, and more reviews equals a higher profile, which means it will reach more of the people who need it. Thank you for your support. For more information, visit pendantaudio.com. Thanks for listening.
Let's all be weird together.